free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine, and let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Thursday, August 7th, 2014. Heading to the Yes concert tonight in Kansas City. That's really none of your concern, I suppose, but that's very much on my mind this morning. But also on my mind is what a terrible president George W. Bush was. And to talk to us about this, we have Anthony Gregory. And by the way, let me justify this topic before I say anything else about Anthony. I am so tired of hearing about Obama. I know Obama's a terrible guy. Okay, anybody with an internet connection or 10 minutes in the library can figure this out. But it causes us to lose sight of how bad his predecessor was. This is true of every president. You forget how bad the predecessor was, and I am tired of seeing "Miss me yet?" signs with George W. Bush on them. No, I don't. I do not miss you at all. So I think just to balance things out in our minds, it's important to do a systematic review of George W. Bush. And I can think of no one better to do this for us than Anthony Gregory. Stay tuned. After my conversation with Anthony Gregory, I've got a nice little announcement about my new book, book number 12. But stay tuned after talking to Anthony Gregory. Anthony Gregory is the Gilbert I. Collins Fellow at the Independent Institute. He's the author of The Power of Habeas Corpus in America, From the King's Prerogative to the War on Terror, published by Cambridge University Press. He holds a bachelor's degree in history from the University of California at Berkeley. Anthony Gregory, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Tom, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
You know, Anthony, I promised this particular episode to my listeners for about a month, and then it so happened that something came up in my personal life, and I couldn't record it with you that day. And then you went and got married, and of course there are all kinds of logistical difficulties when you're trying to arrange a wedding and everything, so we had to postpone it till now. And meanwhile, I was getting emails from people saying, "Hey, you bum, where's Anthony Gregory?" So now they have their answer. And we're going to talk today, I think, about George W. Bush, because there is so much preoccupation with Barack Obama, understandably, but it obscures how terrible his predecessor was. And this happens, I think, with every president. We get so caught up in how terrible this president was that, by implication, we seem to be saying that if only we could go back to the good old days of, you know, 4, 6, 8 years ago. But there were no good old days, and there certainly weren't any good old days with George W. Bush, and one hardly knows where to begin. Like, if you wanted to begin on George W. Bush, I would think you would say the War on Terror, which was the centerpiece of his administration, would be the sensible starting point, would you not?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, his defenders and ardent supporters throughout his administration sure made that the centerpiece. And so let's let them define his presidency.
That's right. That's right. So let's talk about that now. Let's start with foreign policy, since obviously that's the key aspect of the War on Terror. But then, we have the domestic angles of the War on Terror that we're becoming more and more knowledgeable about all the time. But let's go right from the start. After 9/11, not long after 9/11. George W. Bush declared that it was necessary to go to war in Afghanistan because Afghanistan had terrorist training camps and Osama bin Laden, and they were responsible. So what would be wrong with going to war with them? Doesn't it seem like that must be a just war, if anything in world history ever was?
Well, you could see a strong case for trying to apprehend bin Laden and the few leaders who were involved in the particular attacks on 9/11. Of course, the administration failed to get bin Laden. They lost him in the mountains there, Tora Bora. and then just kind of drop the ball and stop taking it very seriously. And although I'm not at all a defender of Obama's foreign policy, I do think it's kind of funny that a lot of the pro-war Bush supporters neglect the fact that it was Obama that finally got bin Laden. But you can make a case for that. But these training camps were Al-Qaeda affiliated, but they weren't the same. They weren't used for the same sorts of missions as 9/11. They were used for ground fighting and stuff like that. I'm not defending the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, but right away, the war in Afghanistan, you know, bombing Kabul, trying to set up some democracy that was soon infiltrated by some of the same Taliban reactionaries we read these horror stories about in the 90s, and this protracted conflict that has continued to this day, America's longest foreign wars, foreign war in many respects. No, that wasn't a just war. In that, the specific goal that people would be the most sympathetic to was not really the centerpiece of that foreign initiative.
Anthony, when I had Eric Margolis on the show not too terribly long ago, I asked him, did he think it was disingenuous when the government in Afghanistan said, we need to see the evidence against bin Laden before we turn him over to you? Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that was just stalling for time, or do you think that was a legitimate request, and how do you think the U.S. government handled that?
I think it's a legitimate request. I mean, I'm not going to... The Taliban's so awful that, you know, it's not... I don't want to, you know, even if they sent a Valentine's Day telegram, I'd say it's from a tainted source, right? But, yeah, in principle, it's legitimate that if a government's claiming someone masterminded a major terror attack on their soil and they're just trying to apprehend these people, there should be evidence. They're certainly before you start going and killing people. But, yeah, I'd say that was in principle a reasonable request, sure.
What do you make of the fact, speaking of evidence, that years later, years after 2003, when the war in Iraq got started, there were still, I don't know, 50 to 70% of Americans who thought that Saddam Hussein had been behind the 9/11 attacks?
Well, okay, so this is a really slimy thing that the war party does. Back in the day, it seemed like the war party would just lie outright more and just say, oh, they did this when they didn't do this. But, you know, the Bush administration never specifically said Saddam was behind 9/11. But the way they talked about Iraq, and the way they'd say that part of the world from which 9/11 was spawned, and the way that they would conflate the war with Al-Qaeda and this war with the secular regime of Saddam Hussein and this propaganda about how supposedly Saddam's people met Al-Qaeda in Prague and all that, it created this fog. And then all of the... You know, all of the ideologues and mostly conservative media, and especially on talk radio and the internet, they started talking about how Saddam did do 9/11. And the Bush administration wasn't very good at coming out and saying, no, we're not saying that at all. And so they sure encouraged that myth that they never explicitly claimed to be the case. And that was really slimy, because they needed that. The Bush administration needed people to believe in propaganda that even the Bush administration was careful not to explicitly disseminate. That sounds a little bit conspiratorial, but that's actually just kind of a dispassionate analysis of what happened. Because month after month, the polls showed that, right? That at times, the majority of Americans thought Saddam was by 9/11. Most of the Republicans certainly did. And the administration never went out of its way to clarify that that wasn't true. They kicked up all this dust, weapons of mass destruction. We don't want a mushroom cloud to be the smoking gun. Remember that?
Yeah.
We need to beware. Remember, they were telling us before the Iraq war started, oh, maybe you could put duct tape under all your doors to protect yourself from anthrax. I mean, the degree of hysteria that they encouraged in that whole slow-motion, year-long run-up to the war in Iraq was gut-wrenching. And I must admit that to this day, the particular dislike I have for the Bush administration and modern conservatives, which I concede at times might bias me too much in the direction of opposing them more than the other side, a lot of it comes from the fact that during these formidable years of mine, when I was in college, I witnessed this slow motion war propaganda campaign to go to war with a completely unrelated country, Iraq, and unleash what I believe to be one of the greatest atrocities of this century, the U.S. war in Iraq.
Anthony, I remember distinctly at the time writing articles on this subject, doing what I could, which was basically nothing, to try to stop this, and actually getting emails from people saying that the reason I wrote pieces like this was that I didn't think brown people deserved or could sustain democracy. And that's really what was motivating me, was my dislike of brown people. And didn't they deserve a chance at democracy? Well, Anthony, let me ask you, didn't brown people deserve a chance at democracy?
Well, better yet, I'd say brown people and all people deserve a chance at liberty, and they deserve a chance at having freedom and property rights and peace and not being killed either by their own governments or by the U.S. Army. But that was part of, I remember there was a particular strain of pro-war thought that ran along those lines, that if, especially if it was pushed on this democratic peace theory, that if you opposed the war, it was because you were some kind of reactionary who didn't care about the rights of foreigners. But at the same time, if you objected to bombing Baghdad, the idea was, well, you're putting the rights of foreigners over the rights of Americans not to be terrorized. This is a dynamic I've written about, this shifting rationale for war, that on the one hand, Americans must sacrifice blood and treasure for the worthy freedoms of foreigners, but on the other hand, the U.S. government has to sacrifice the lives of foreigners to defend Americans and their rights. And lo and behold, it's always the government that engages in this calculus of deciding whose rights and blood should be sacrificed on the altar of maximizing the good of the world. And lo and behold, the government often totally fails at making this calculation. And right now in Iraq and in much of the Middle East, we see Bush and the neocons' freedom dominoes tipping with some of the most horrible bloodshed in the modern history of that region. And they said that the Iraq war was for democracy, which became their selling point when they couldn't find weapons of mass destruction. At first the thing was, those Iraqis are a threat, so we got to go over there, and we're going to install democracy. And then when the national defense rationale became clearly a ruse, or at least it fell through, then all of a sudden it was about the Iraqi elections, we're going to have democracy. But look at what that's yielded. Saddam Hussein was one of the most horrible butchers of the late 20th century. But the reason that the U.S. supported him was because it saw him as a break on this kind of Islamist radicalism, right? And I don't support the U.S.'s foreign policy in Iraq at all, including in its previous support for Saddam Hussein. But here we see that when you overthrow that horrible regime, the result is not a Jeffersonian Mesopotamia. The result is another sort of horrible humanitarian disaster, and you know, brown people, white people, yellow people, dark people, of course, all people should have liberty and peace. But the political culture and institutions in the Middle East are very problematic. And when you go in there and you kill one faction, you usually end up strengthening another. And you might think that the faction you're killing is the worst one, but often that's just because it's the one in power. And the one that rises up often becomes at least as bad or worse.
Anthony, I want you to be blunt. Say what's on your mind on this question. Why is it that, given that we know that there were no weapons of mass destruction, that we know, I think, with reasonable certainty that the Bush administration didn't actually think there were, and given that they obviously are not staying up nights worried about so-called human rights around the world, then why did they do it? Why did they go after Iraq? I mean, it could be, according to the progressives, that it was about oil. I find that unpersuasive. What do you think the real reason was?
Well, you know, it's multifaceted. Some people in the administration probably did believe their own propaganda down the line. They picked weapons of mass destruction because it was the most, it's the one everyone could agree on in terms of getting Americans on their side for the war. But of course, you know, there's the neocons who had their long time theory going back at least to the 90s, the whole project of the new American century of securing the Middle East, particularly for Israel, and by proxy for the United States, by encouraging democracies to rise up and replace these autocracies and Islamic regimes, Islamist regimes. You know, there was of course Bush. Bush the second did have some particularly personal issues with Iraq that probably had to do with the frustrations of his dad going to war with Iraq and not finishing the job and then losing re-election. I think that did have a little bit to do with it. There was a lot of money to be made. I think that the oil argument was always misguided insofar as it was this theory that the U.S. just wanted to go in and steal the oil and give it to Americans for cheap. I mean, certainly oil prices don't reflect that. More interesting were the theories that some oil interests wanted to keep other oil off the market. But yeah, I think that the economic arguments or the economic impetus was secondary. I think there was an ideological desire, and I guess if you scratch the surface enough, there's a good intention there that you would have peace and freedom and America would be protected and Israel would be protected and all these Arab governments and eventually the Iranian government as well could be liberalized. And, you know, it's a completely total... It's a fantasy to think that a government could centrally plan this sort of social revolution for a billion people, but it's no crazier than communism, and a lot of these neocons used to dabble in that too. So what do you expect?
And interestingly enough, the neocons in the 70s and probably early 80s. Were more or less adopting, I don't think they realized it, but they were more or less adopting the progressive line on the Soviet Union, which was that the Soviet Union is economically quite successful and therefore, from the neocon point of view, was a huge, huge threat to the U.S. I mean, look at the statistics coming out of the Soviet Union. Now, the neocons are supposed to at least nominally believe in the free market, and yet here they are honestly believing basically what Paul Samuelson taught, which was that central planning can survive and even thrive. You know, I mean, it's amazing how gullible they were.
Well, yeah. It's funny. A lot of the same people think that the arms race bankrupted the Soviets. So I guess some planning, some spending was bad for that government. Of course, these same people don't think the arms race was bad for America.
All right, let's talk about the domestic side, though, of the war on terror. I mean, we've got the TSA, we've got the NSA, we've got the Patriot Act. you know, I mean, we could have a separate show on each one of these. As you look at, as you survey the whole war on terror on the domestic front, what rankles you the most? What do you think is the worst outrage?
Well, I guess briefly I mentioned something that's not technically domestic, but more on the civil liberties, human rights side. It's just the detention policy and the torture and the, these new justifications for torture, the mass roundup of captives in Iraq, and of course Guantanamo, where there are still people, a non-trivial number of them are innocent for all practical purposes of anything remotely resembling terrorism, who are still there being mistreated, force-fed in some cases. It's just completely disgusting, and it's a rot. If a country can have a culture as a national culture that's somehow represented by government, I don't like that idea. But insofar as it happens, having your government rubber stamp torture is pretty terrible. But more purely domestically, although the NSA, of course, is potentially the most horrific in its power, because it's a total surveillance state that Bush began to build and Obama's expanded upon. I think one thing that's kind of more symbolically representative of what Bush did to this country is the TSA. So I don't think the TSA is as big of an intrusion or violation of our dignity as some of this other stuff. But boy, a lot of these conservatives started protesting the TSA in 2009 and 10. Did you remember that?
Yeah, even Mike Huckabee, I remember.
Right when Obama won, all of a sudden they recognized that a lot of police state stuff had been built up. But it wasn't built up by Obama, at least not initially. And Bush, you know, created a whole new department. And it wasn't just, you know, some department of, you know, desk size regulation or something a Democrat like, which would be terrible, or a department of some welfare service, which is bad enough, but a Department of Homeland Security, which to me sounds very Orwellian, very fascistic, redundant, since you also have a Department of Defense.
Right, exactly. Right? What's that been doing all these years?
Well, not defending America.
Apparently not.
And not defending many other people. A lot of offense, right, is the cliche. But yeah, the Department of Homeland Security and the Transportation Security Administration. So, you know, the biggest problem I have with the airports is not the intrusions themselves, but the cultural effect.
I was thinking the same thing. Okay, yeah, go with this.
Okay, so I have a number of libertarian friends who are in their early 20s, so about 10 years younger than me, and they're pretty radical, and they're against this stuff, so I'm not claiming that they support this, but they're a little less radical than I am about this particular issue, and I think it's partly because, you know, they were 10 or whatever when this stuff was created, so they hardly remember a time when airports were considerably less intrusive. And back when I traveled in the 90s, yeah, I mean, there was the metal detector, right? So it wasn't like a laissez-faire environment. But it felt kind of like you were in a civilized place. And, you know, I don't want to overstate this. I mean, the TSA agents, I don't think that they're like, you know, East Germany's police force or anything like that. But that's not the point. Culturally, this idea that, oh, you're going to board a plane, sir? Well, we're going to need to take your water. You're going to have to take your shoes off. You're going to have to take your belt off. Oh, this week, we're also going to say you can't have lotion. Oh, now you can have 3 ounces of lotion. I mean, because, you know, lotion could, you know, blow up a plane unless it's less than 3 ounces or whatever the rationale
is. Yeah.
This is, airports are one of the most significant, you know, fulcrums of globalization and of civilization. You've got people all over the world connecting. And when people travel within the United States as well, and they're going through this every time they travel, it nails home the point that the government owns the main networks of transportation. And this could just ratchet upward. I mean, eventually they'd probably want to move on to stadiums and buses and trains, and they've already done a little bit of this. But it's just the false sense of security, the fact that they get more intrusive, and maybe they'll back off a little. But I swear, in 30 years, if the trajectory continues, people are going to, you know, have to do a full-blown strip search when they travel. And kids are going to ask their parents, why do we do this? And their parents are going to say, oh, because of something that happened in New York City 45 years ago. I mean, we're already at this point where it just seems odd. You know, I mean, usually America goes through these crises and overreacts and violates civil liberties. But the crises only last a few years, like World War I and II. And so those were more extreme overreactions. Although the threat was also bigger as far as that goes. But then at least it passed. At least 1947 was a much different America from 1942, right? They closed down those internment camps in between those years, right?
Right.
Whereas now it's 2014 and we're still cowering as though it's 2001.
We have this phenomenon now of conservatives who are saying that they miss George W. Bush, right? Miss me yet? Oh, this whole thing, right? Now, bearing in mind that these conservatives, by and large, probably thought his foreign policy was good, we'll leave that aside. We can, of course, make a great argument against his foreign policy. I think the headlines today are a great argument against his foreign policy, but leave that aside. Just from the point of view of things these people are supposed to believe in, according to their own stated views, what can you say, especially in domestic affairs now, what can you say to them about George W. Bush and his record?
Well, he started off with a bang with No Child Left Behind that was drafted with Ted Kennedy. He pushed through Medicare D, the largest expansion of the welfare state since the Great Society and up until Obamacare. He signed off on Sarbanes-Oxley, which was the most intrusive regulation in, you know, the finance sector that had... The Bush administration claimed credit for the most stiff regulation since the New Deal in a fundraising letter. I still have from, I think, 2002. And then he ended his presidency signing the TARP bailouts, the biggest, you know, the biggest giveaway of federal taxpayer money in modern memory. But one thing that I think really gets to the core here is, you know, I really don't like Obama, but I must say that although there's 2 years left, so we don't know, we as historians, we probably won't be able to judge these things dispassionately for decades. But I still think Bush is the worst president of my lifetime. And one thing that should really get conservatives on board is what they did, what the federal government did in assisting local officials after Katrina and going door-to-door and confiscating personal weapons. It didn't end up being the biggest deal, but the precedent is bad. Could you imagine if Obama did that?
Oh, we would never hear the end of it.
Oh, Obama's terrible on this issue, on the right to bear arms, although in practice, I think Bush, between Project Safe Neighborhoods and Katrina and the gun control in Baghdad and everything, was maybe worse. But this isn't just like some tax on ammunition, as horrible and unjustified as that is. This is actually going to people's homes at a time when they most need the right to bear arms, according to conservative reasoning, right? There's looting. There's the threat of big government if you go that far in your radicalism. But there's certainly the threat of private crime. And these government officials went door to door, and they seized American weapons. And this legal firearm, which is, if Obama did that, even after something worse than Katrina, you know, you'd never see the end of the calls for impeachment, of the cries that Obama's a Maoist dictator who was born on Mars, who's come here to implement full-blown totalitarianism and, you know, suck our bioenergy. I'm just saying it would actually go overboard.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
But with Bush, they did this, and the NRA put out a release that basically said, yeah, he shouldn't have done that. And that was that.
Yeah, that was it.
It wasn't like they always draw these lines in the sand. Oh, well, if a government does this. And almost all of the stuff that they hated on Obama, Bush did. I mean, there are things Obama's done with Obamacare and Dodd-Frank and the stimulus and some of these executive orders that are particular and horrible. But I don't know. Anyone who looks, and the same is cuts true the other way. If you're a progressive who thinks Obama's great and Bush was terrible, that doesn't line up either. But you can't look at the Bush administration and everything he did and pushed for actively. I mean, if Obama pushed for $15 billion more in foreign aid to Africa to fight AIDS, they'd attack him. You know, if Bush's ownership society, right, where he put all of this political capital behind getting people into homes that they couldn't afford. You remember that?
Yeah, of course.
That had some consequences, I seem to recall.
Yeah, I know, but we can sort of overlook them. And, you know, there is, I was going to bring up the Tea Party, but you and I will talk for 3 hours about the Tea Party, and we can't. We have to start wrapping up. Maybe we'll talk about that at some point, because there were some decent people and instincts at the very beginning of the Tea Party when they wanted to vote people out who had voted for TARP. There was no establishment organization saying, let's vote out people who voted for TARP. That was just regular Americans. Now, of course, it's become a wing of the Republican Party, and they have a wink and a nod when they say, yes, this Republican wasn't very good. But it's the Democrats that they're concerned about. And the Democrats, sometimes I forget how terrible they are because I don't pay any attention to them anymore. But sure. For heaven's sake, at this point, it should be screamingly obvious that what you are facing is a whole regime that is opposed to you. It takes two forms with their cosmetic differences. But when push comes to shove, they both support the bailouts and they both support the wars and they both support the expansion of the state. That should be obvious by now. I'm losing my patience with these people.
Yeah, and, you know, you could come up with some arguments, and you and I have argued about angels on the head, or maybe we should say devils on the head of a pin.
That's right.
Many, many evenings and many days, but, I mean, let's be super generous and say that Bush and Obama are only 80% the same. I think that's pretty generous.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that Bush and Obama each have specific passions that drove specific policies, but they both maintain the same, almost everything from their predecessors has been kept, and then they do some other bad things. But honestly, Bush, I think, he had 9/11, though again, Obama had the financial collapse as a rationale for government expansion. But I honestly think Bush ratcheted government in a bad direction more post-Clinton than Obama has post-Bush. I was actually...
Oh, yeah. I don't think that's even debatable.
Yeah. I think Obama's... I mean, we're spending... Well, they're spending. They're stealing and spending like mad. But Bush's last budget was completely outrageous. It was on this... Because of TARP and everything. But Bush... The character of American governance shifted more under the Bush years than today. Because I don't feel much different. I don't feel much more threatened than I did when we had these endless terror alerts. And when Fox News... Also, when MSNBC is the full-time pro-regime news station, it's awful, but it's there's some, like, it's kitsch. It's awful. They're horrible. They smear people, including some of our friends. But remember when Fox News was basically Karl Rove's media center from like 2002 to 2004 or 5?
Yeah.
That was really frightening.
A lot of people have a lot of penance to do for things that they enabled by means of that.
Oh, yeah.
Listen, Anthony, I love talking to you. It's like when I have you on, it's like we're just on the phone talking to each other, and that's exactly what I want the show to be like. We're just talking. It's not an interviewer asking questions and so on. It's just you and me talking. I want to direct people to anthonygregory.com. I already told people about your important book on habeas corpus, and of course to the Independent Institute, where I'm speaking to you right now, or you're at the Independent Institute anyway, at independent.org. Anything else I should promote?
No, I think that's good.
All right, well, Anthony, thanks for your time. We'll have to have you on to talk about some other rotten president one of these days, or anything that in the news, anything that you're writing about, passionate about, contact me. I want to have you back on.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
All right, everybody, so here's my news. I finished the book. I finished it. It's incredible. A couple of months ago, I didn't even know I was going to write a book, and now I've finished it. It's called Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. And if you think that subtitle is too long, a lot of nonfiction subtitles are that long. Meltdown's subtitle was about three times as long. I hated that subtitle, but the marketing people at Regnery knew what they were doing. I'm self-publishing this one, just as an experiment to see how that goes. So I'll have to rely a lot more on word of mouth than I would normally have to do. I won't have a big marketing arm behind it of a major publisher. I've never tried this before, but I think it's worth doing. And I'm doing it in large part as a thanks to you guys who support the show. In fact, the dedication page reads, "To my listeners at TomWoodsRadio.com." So all of you who are supporting listeners, who have joined the program at SupportingListeners.com, we'll be getting the Kindle edition as part of your support for the show, as a reward for the support that you've shown for the show. You can do that at supportinglisteners.com. As I keep telling you, I got a bunch of goodies set up for you guys. I'm going to be talking today to my web guy who's setting up the website where my courses for the Ron Paul homeschool program will be available a la carte, and those will also be benefits that those of you with the higher levels of support will get. My courses for the Ron Paul homeschool program are not intended for high school students alone. I teach them at a level that would not insult the intelligence of an adult who just feels like, I really need to know this stuff, and I never got it, and here's your chance to do so painlessly. So check that out, supportinglisteners.com. Remember, I'll be in Nashville August 15th, nightofclarity.com. I'll be in Boise, Idaho, October 25th, so save that date on your calendar. And please, please, if you enjoyed this episode, I assure you, you'll enjoy all the episodes. So make sure and subscribe over at TomWoodsRadio.com. We have links to subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher, and you won't miss a single episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.